Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Iran's president says his country's ultimate revenge for the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani would be the complete withdrawal of U.S. troops from the region. Syria says it has thwarted an Israeli aggression on the capital, Damascus, amid an upsurge in Israeli attacks on the Arab country. And also in our headlines, U.S. President-elect Joe Biden criticizes Donald Trump's promised swift coronavirus vaccine rollout, saying it has fallen behind expectations. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half-hour: Iran's president says his country's ultimate revenge for the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani will be the complete withdrawal of U.S. forces from the region. Hassan Rouhani said Iran has the right to take revenge for the U.S. killing of the top Iranian general. He said the U.S. killed Soleimani because he truly fought terrorism. Rouhani added the region owes its security and stability to the assassinated general. The Iranian president also said the U.S. and Israel are the only beneficiaries of insecurity in the region. Rouhani made the comments in a cabinet meeting ahead of the first anniversary of Soleimani's assassination. The top general was killed in a U.S. drone attack near Iraq's capital, Baghdad, on January the 3rd. Lebanese authors and artists have paid tribute to Iranian top commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and the first anniversary of his assassination by the U.S. in Iraq. They unanimously maintained that the general managed to win the hearts and minds of the people in the region. Mariam Saleh reports from Beirut.
These days, Lebanon is hosting various events marking the first anniversary of the martyrdom of Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. This book reads, "The Man Who Vanquished America," will be out in bookstores on the martyrdom anniversary on January 3rd. The author tells Press TV he started writing after the martyrdom of General Qasem Soleimani in January 2020, and the main inspiration for him was the personality of the man who changed the region and even the world.
This man is the man, in terms of strategy, is the man of the century. The United States could not beat him. On the contrary, he defeated the United States in many posts, in many positions, in many places, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Iran, and in Syria, in Lebanon, in Yemen, in Palestine. So he outsmarted them.
One of the main discernments of deep study of the assassination of General Soleimani was that the will of the resistance will be more adamant on removing the U.S. hegemonic presence from the region.
Achieved nothing. They killed the freedom in their mind when they killed Haj Qasem Soleimani. They killed justice in their mind and in their people when they killed Haj Qasem Soleimani. On the contrary, Haj Qasem Soleimani now is living in every person or a thinker who think that Haj Qasem Soleimani represents such slogans, freedom, justice, and liberty.
U.S. Army generals and strategists, as well as those who grieved him, agree that the commander of the Quds Force brought the people of West Asia together and made the cause of fighting U.S. oppression a united struggle. Other virtual events to commemorate the memory of the Iranian commander were held by a group of activists in the form of Lebanese traditional storytelling. Through this art form, the writers tried to narrate to the people of Lebanon the story of Commander Qasem Soleimani and his significant role in thwarting U.S. plots.
The biggest shock was when the U.S. Army General Petraeus read a message which read, "I am Qasem Soleimani, the commander of Al-Quds forces. I am the one who conducts the Iranian policies in Iraq, Afghanistan, Gaza, and the entire region. And the Iranian ambassador in Iran is a member of the Quds force."
Many in the region who knew General Qasem Soleimani or learned about him after his martyrdom say they have no doubt that his martyrdom and the deeds done during his lifetime will lead to a complete liberation of the region. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The first anniversary of the U.S. assassination of Iran's anti-terror icon is just around the corner. Correspondents in Pakistan and Indian-controlled Kashmir have talked to the people about their opinions regarding Iran's Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Let's take a listen.
General Soleimani was a brave man. He was a symbol against capitalization, not only in Iran, also for all the countries in the region.
Look who was General Qasem Soleimani. He was fighting against Daesh, a proxy of international establishment, you can say Americans. And Americans who were supposed to call Daesh a terrorist, and instead of fighting against Daesh, they were fighting against General Qasem Soleimani.
General Qasem Soleimani was a sign of unity among Muslims. He was struggling to unify Muslims. But imperialistic forces like the US and Israel are dead against the unity among Muslims. Therefore, they killed him.
General Qasem Soleimani was not only working for the cause of Shia communities of the world, but in fact, he was working for the entire Muslim Ummah. That is why he emerged as a hero and fearless leader.
The absence of General Soleimani is not being felt by Iranians alone, but by all the oppressed people around the world. General Soleimani was a great revolutionary and a hero beyond the borders. He will always have a special place in the hearts of the oppressed and the poor.
I have closely watched and I have closely read and I have closely followed General Qasem Soleimani for a long time. I personally believe his only school of thought is to help and develop humanity. Let's talk about his school of thought. He precisely believes that if there is a suppression, if there is an oppression anywhere going on around the world, be it any part of the world, leave it whether it's a Muslim nation, non-Muslim nation, it's anywhere. He is trying to oppose that.
His, his assassination has deeply affected the Middle East. Not only Middle East, in fact, it has affected the whole world politics.
Generally, when such high-profile assassinations are carried out, the countries do not take credit for the assassinations. But the manner in which the United States of America took credit of eliminating General Qasem Soleimani, it tells us that he has been a high-value target for them. His killing has been, a high-profile killing, and also tells us about the stature of that, military person who is also credited of, trying to forge unity and trying to forge a partnership between the Muslim, powerful leaders in the Muslim world.
A year has passed since Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, was assassinated by the U.S. To Iranians, he was an anti-terror icon who played a key role in maintaining security in their country. But his popularity among Iranians goes beyond a charismatic commander who defeated the Daesh terror group. Soleimani is also highly appreciated for his selflessness and modesty. That explains why people refer to him as the commander of hearts.
Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, visiting a group of children in the northern province of Mazandaran months before his assassination. These children were amongst many more who had lost their fathers in Iran's anti-terror operations. The top general had a message for the children, that he is always there despite being busy as a military commander. And he did whatever he could to fill the void those children had, being so kind that the kids expressed their feelings whenever they wished, even if it was in the middle of praying. But now, all those moments are over. They came to an end after Soleimani lost his life in a U.S. drone attack near Iraq's capital, Baghdad. The bad news came to the Iranians in the early hours of January 5th, 2020. Many demanded revenge. revenge for the killing of a person they called the Commander of Hearts. They all remembered that Soleimani was a man of the people, a man who considered it an honor to serve those in need. That was quite clear in the spring of 2019 when many Iranian provinces were hit by devastating floods. General Soleimani and a number of friends went to the southern province of Khuzestan, one of the hardest hit areas by the unprecedented deluge. There, he joined others delivering relief and aid to flood-hit people. He extended his support to anyone needed within his reach. A humble person that behaved his countrymen with respect, regardless of his position as the head of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, a key force responsible for Iran's anti-terror operations overseas. Millions turned out for Soleimani's funeral processions held in several Iranian cities, including his hometown, Kerman. The ceremonies were the last chance for people to pay respect to a person they were always proud of, not only for his brave actions on the front line, but more for his humane behavior.
Moving on, Israeli military has carried out an attack on the Syrian capital, Damascus, killing one soldier and injuring three others. According to a Syrian military source, the airstrike targeted an air defense unit in the Nabi Habil area, located in the west of Damascus countryside. The source noted that some of the missiles were intercepted by the country's air defense systems. The incident comes days after Syria's air defense forces intercepted an Israeli airstrike on the western Hama province. The recent upsurge in the number of Israeli attacks are seen as a reaction to the Syrian forces' success in battling foreign-backed terror groups seeking to topple the government of President Bashar al-Assad. Our correspondent Muhammad Ali joins us now from the Syrian capital, Damascus. Muhammad, what details do you have to share with us regarding the nature of the Israeli attack in Damascus?
Yes, Israel carried out a new aggression on Syria. An official Syrian military source confirmed that and said that at 1:30 a.m. Local time in Damascus, the Israeli enemy carried out airstrikes targeting with several missiles a Syrian air defense unit northwest of Damascus in an area called Nabi Habil. The airstrikes led to the killing of one Syrian army personnel and the injury of three others. A military source also said that the air defense system was able to intercept a number of the missiles that Israel attacked this unit with. Of course, it's not the first time. The Syrian Foreign Ministry did not comment on this particular attack, but just 20 hours before this attack in Damascus, Syria's Assistant Foreign Minister Ayman Soussan said that in a press conference that the repeated Israeli attacks are aimed at making up for the terrorists' losses on Syria's soil. Usually, the Syrian Foreign Ministry says that those Israeli attacks are in direct support of the remaining terrorists. Ayman Soussan also said 20 hours before this particular attack that those repeated Israeli attacks on Syria are also aiming at renewing what he described as the plot of aggression on Syria. Previously, all officials in Syria usually say that those attacks aim to undermine and weaken the strength of the Syrian army on Syria's soil.
Also, yeah, that's exactly where I was going next with the timing of these aggressions that the Israelis carry out against Damascus. The upsurge in the number of those attacks are seen, as you mentioned, as a reaction to the Syrian forces' success in battling the foreign-backed terror groups, which have been seeking for years to topple the government of President Bashar al-Assad. Those attacks, the assistance to those foreign terrorist groups haven't been successful, though, have they?
Well, no, because the Syrian army continues to achieve victories on the ground against the remaining terrorists. However, what the Israeli side wants to do is that it wants to send a message to those remaining terrorists on the ground that they are backing them. Whenever they're losing ground, they want to send such kind of a message to those terrorists. We remember when terrorists used to occupy, particularly the Al-Nusra Front areas, on the separation line with the occupied Syrian Golan. Whenever the Syrian army advances there, at the same day, we used to see Israeli airstrikes on them. So this is not a surprise for the Syrian government. They know over here, the officials, that Israel is backing directly those remaining terrorists, regardless of who they are, Nusra Front or any other terrorist group on the ground. The enemy of those terrorist groups and Israel is one, which is the Syrian army. And what Israel's trying to do always is to weaken the Syrian army, first to send a message to the terrorists that they're backing them, second, in an attempt to weaken the Syrian army and try to halt its successes and victories on the ground. But so far, the Syrian army was not affected. The Syrian army, with its allies, continue to strike every terrorist position in Syria, wherever it is. And definitely, we always hear the officials in Syria saying that the Syrian army will continue its fight until liberating every inch of Syrian soil, regardless of what is happening on the ground.
All right, thanks a lot, Mohammed Ali, joining us from the Syrian capital, Damascus. Elsewhere, Iran's foreign minister has repeated Tehran's warning about the consequences of any adventurism by the United States in the Persian Gulf region. Mohammad Javad Zarif made the warning in a phone conversation with his Qatari counterpart, Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdulrahman al-Thani. Zarif also reiterated the need for regional cooperation to maintain stability and peace in the Persian Gulf while avoiding tensions and foreign interference. Tensions have been running high in the Persian Gulf since the U.S. deployed a nuclear submarine to the region following a rocket attack on its Baghdad embassy. Washington blamed the attack on Iranian-backed groups, but Tehran rejected the allegations and called the attack suspicious. U.S. President-elect Joe Biden says the Trump administration's plan to distribute coronavirus vaccines is falling dangerously short.
The Trump administration's plan to distribute vaccines is falling behind, far behind. But as I long feared and warned, the effort to distribute and administer the vaccine is not progressing as it should. A few weeks ago, the Trump administration suggested that 20 million Americans could be vaccinated by the end of December. With only a few days left in December, we've only vaccinated a few million so far.
Biden pledged a relentless effort to fight COVID-19 the moment he takes office on January the 20th. He said he would invoke a law to force private industry to step up vaccine production for the government. Biden also said he would mandate wearing face masks in areas where the federal government has jurisdiction. So far, more than 19.5 million people have been infected by COVID in the U.S. Of them, over 338,000 have died. Both are the largest in the world. Daily cases have spiked in the U.S. in recent weeks. Officials say they would surge further due to holiday season travels. Total coronavirus fatalities have exceeded 500,000 in Latin America and the Caribbean. Based on official figures, Brazil accounts for more than a third of COVID deaths in the region, with nearly 193,000 fatalities. The country on Tuesday posted over 1,100 new deaths. That was its highest daily toll in 3 months. Mexico reported nearly 1,000 new fatalities the same day. Its death toll is now above 123,000. That accounts for more than a quarter of total COVID fatalities in Latin America and the Caribbean. Health authorities have expressed concern about year-end celebrations and their impact on the already fragile health systems in the region. Argentina's Senate has passed a bill to legalize abortion in the homeland of Pope Francis. The yes vote is expected to have repercussions across Latin America, where abortion is seen as a taboo. The approval comes despite opposition from the Catholic Church. Earlier, Pope, in a tweet, implicitly called on Argentinian senators to reject the motion. Thousands of both pro- and anti-abortion demonstrators watched the debate outside Congress on giant screens. The bill authorizes voluntary abortion up to the 14th week of pregnancy. Prior to that, terminations were only allowed in two cases of danger to the mother's life and rape. A Chinese court has handed down prison sentences to 10 Hong Kong anti-government protesters. The sentences vary from 7 months to 3 years. The court found the defendants guilty of illegally crossing from Hong Kong to Taiwan in August. Fines of more than $3,000 were also imposed on them. Officials said the group included two minors who would be returned to Hong Kong without facing charges. The city has seen sporadic anti-government protests in the past months, partly over a security law. Chinese and Hong Kong officials say the law aims to improve security, and the city opponents reject this. And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Our darkest days in the battle against COVID-19 are ahead of us, not behind us, the U.S. top infectious disease expert predicted. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Brett Wilkins Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Surge on a Surge. Fauci leads health officials warning of post-holiday coronavirus spike. Here's the details of this article. The United States will most likely experience a post-seasonal spike in coronavirus infections, largely due to holiday travel and gatherings, current and former U.S. health officials said recently. We very well might see a post-seasonal, in the sense of Christmas, New Year's surge, a surge upon a surge, Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, and an incoming chief medical advisor to Joe Biden, said on CNN's State of the Union. We're really at a very critical point, he warned. I share the concern of Biden that as we get into the next few weeks, it might actually get worse, Fauci added, referring to Biden's prediction earlier this week that our darkest days in the battle against COVID-19 are ahead of us, not behind us. U.S. Surgeon General Jeremy Adams also said that a post-holiday infection surge was likely. But what the important thing for people to understand is that even if you traveled, it doesn't mean you just throw your hands up in the air and say, oh well, he said on ABC this week. There are measures that you can take, said Adams, including getting tested, self-quarantining, and avoiding vulnerable people such as the elderly and those with pre-existing conditions. Former U.S. Food and Drug Administration Commissioner Scott Gottlieb, appearing on CBS Face the Nation, predicted a grim month for Americans. We have a very difficult month ahead of us, he said, identifying California, Massachusetts, New York, and New Jersey as places where cases are still building. When asked how long it will be until the U.S. sees results from the two vaccines, which have been administered to some 1.9 million Americans and counting, Gottlieb said that while vaccinations are going to take about 3 weeks to get through all the nursing homes, there will be some indication that mass inoculation is probably having an effect maybe as early as this week. Fauci told CNN that in order to achieve herd immunity, the effective neutralization of the virus following the infection or vaccination of enough people, 70% to 85% of the public would likely need to be inoculated. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported 179,104 new coronavirus infections and 1,309 new daily deaths on Sunday, December 27th, for a total of 18.9 million U.S. infections and 330,901 COVID-19 deaths during the nine-month pandemic. The health experts' warnings came the morning after Trump refused to sign $900 billion pandemic relief bill, allowing unemployment coverage for millions of Americans to expire, and threatening millions more with eviction as a federal moratorium was set to expire at the end of the year. Trump acquiesced to bipartisan pressure and later on Sunday, December 27th, signed a $2.3 trillion COVID-19 relief and a spending bill that will provide vaccine distribution, unemployment, small business, and airline company assistance and fund the U.S. government through September 2021. According to reports, the total number of confirmed cases of COVID-19 recorded in the U.S. since the pandemic began passed 19 million on Sunday, December 27th, according to figures tabulated by Johns Hopkins University. The outbreak in the U.S. is growing rapidly, with a million cases added in the last 5 days and a million cases added in the 6 days before that. After recording more than 100,000 cases in one day, for the first time in early November, the U.S. recorded 226,274 cases on Saturday, December 26th, according to Johns Hopkins. The COVID tracking project says the U.S. averaged 185,000 cases a day between December 19 and 26. The nation has recorded 332,502 COVID-19 deaths since the pandemic began. The latest grim milestone comes as health experts warn a surge in cases is likely in the next few weeks as a result of people traveling and gathering for the holiday. As we have gone from the late fall to the early winter, the numbers really are quite troubling, Fauci said on CNN. A more infectious strain of the virus is also spreading primarily in the United Kingdom, even as both the US and UK begin rolling out distribution of the two vaccines for COVID-19. Officials have moved to place heavy restrictions on travel from the UK, but have warned that some people carrying the new strain may have already arrived in the United States of America.
The debate. Hello and a warm welcome to the debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Nimitz operated in the Persian Gulf for 2 months until early November. That's the longest time that a U.S. aircraft carrier has spent in this region since 2018. An Israeli submarine headed for the same region, coinciding with a sighting of submarine USS Georgia. On December 9, two American B-52 bombers headed for the Persian Gulf, accompanied by Saudi aircraft. All this ahead of the first anniversary of the assassination of Iran's senior commander, Soleimani, in a U.S. drone attack near Baghdad Airport. What's the widespread deployment for? Would this stabilize the Middle East region or stir the situation? Now let's go to Washington, D.C. to our correspondent, Colin Campbell. There, Colin, tell us about how the media has been covering this and reactions to this.
Well, to answer your first question, I would say not very much at all, to be honest. We're really focused a lot here on COVID-19 and the rise of the number of Americans who are dying from a pandemic that the government did not responsibly respond to. But as far as other elements of media that are covering this event, there are some that are speculating as to why there is such a buildup of the Navy in around the Strait of Hormuz, and that could be to send a sign to Iran for some reason or another as we battle also with a transition of power here in the country. We have a president who seems very reluctant to relinquish power to the incoming president-elect Biden, but of course the real difference will happen on January 20th. That's really the day that the president-elect will be inaugurated, but along the way, it doesn't seem like the current president wants to give in to that or accept the terms of the election. So meanwhile, he's building up the Navy in this region, along with his leaders in foreign policy, to show a sign to Iran that maybe that, you know, we're still very active in that region. And so if there's any type of aggression that is directed towards the U.S., now is not the time to do it. But again, that's mere conjecture. We're not really sure exactly why there is such a buildup there. We do know that it's the first time in decades that so many members of the Navy have gone there, especially when you see these types of posturing with the USS Georgia going through the Strait of Hormuz, accompanied by other submarines, which pack a lot of firepower. And one has to imagine that this is just something as an act of intimidation, perhaps, or an implicit type of threat that is supposed to be taken as an implication of potential provocation if there is a feeling of being threatened by Iran towards the U.S.
Okay, I got to apologize for the technical glitch that happened in the live show. It's natural. So I got to thank our correspondent, Colin Campbell, who joined us from Washington, D.C., and told us about the reactions of the media and also relevant to stories. Now, I'll be joined by national security analyst and political commentator Brian Downing out of Florida. Brian, good to have you with us. General Kenneth McKenzie, Jr., who heads the U.S. Central Command, says the deployment is an example of Washington-Tel Aviv's what it calls a strong working relationship and shared commitment to regional security and stability. Is this in good faith?
Well, it could be seen as simply signaling that there's not a war coming, that there is not an attack coming. I've been very skeptical of these war's imminent scenarios for many, many years. It doesn't mean I'll be correct this time. But I don't think there is going to be an attack. I think Trump is really just posturing, signaling, preening, beating his breast. I don't think he's going to do it. I don't think the generals want to do it. The generals and admirals don't want it. They have priorities elsewhere. They have been stuck in wars in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan for up to 20 years now. They see bigger fish in the geopolitical world out there. They would, if they were given an order today or in the next few days to attack Iran, I think they would say, well, we don't have enough assets in the area. And they probably do, but they'll still say that. And the United States has had more assets in the Persian Gulf than they have right now. I think they'll say they have to consult our allies. They may even pull the MasterCard and say, we have to consult Congress. That would certainly be a first in American foreign policy in quite a while. I just don't think that there is a war coming. Could be wrong this time, but that's my view.
Okay. Now, from San Francisco, we have Richard Becker, who is with the Answer Coalition, also joining us. Good to have you with us, Richard. Some observers argue that the recent military deployments by Israel, the U.S., and Saudi Arabia aim to dissuade Iran from responding to the killing of its nuclear scientists, Fakhrizadeh. Let's have your take on that.
Well, I think that the situation is a dangerous situation that exists now. And the fact that nuclear weapon equipped ships are being sent into the region, not that they're not there a lot, but that they're very openly saying, you know, we're coming in, the Navy doesn't usually announce ahead of time, or many times they don't announce at all, where they have deployed nuclear weapons carrying equipment, ships, but they did this time. And your other guest may be right that this may be a show of force. I certainly hope that it is. The weaponry, though, that's deployed there is enough to not only destroy Iran, pretty much they're able to destroy the world. And, you know, there has been, over the last 70 years, there have been many, many close calls to the use of nuclear weapons. Some of them are completely unintentional. Some of them based on, you know, misreading the skies. That almost happened. And so, you know, any time that you take this weaponry out and you deploy it, and it's deployed all over the seas, all over the world, particularly the U.S. Navy, with its nuclear weapon ships, it runs a risk. So I don't think that the Iranian government has any interest at all in war, of course, and has to really take into account the fact that they're seeing this deployment. And it's not only the U.S., but Israel, which has, I believe, recently become nuclear weapons equipped with its submarines through the aid of Germany, has also deployed into the region. So it's there's a huge deployment of military force there. It constitutes a danger. And the U.S. acts here and through the corporate media here as if Iran is doing the provocation, when in fact this is clearly a provocation by the United States and Israel.
Now, Brian, since November, Tel Aviv has put its embassies on high alert. And also Richard mentioned, it's also dispatched a submarine to the Persian Gulf. Are these the right moves? What could be behind this?
Well, I think a lot of embassies are on alert around the Middle East, American, Saudi, just about all of them. I think the weapon to look at would be the massive order, the targets to look at would be the nuclear uranium enrichment plants at Natanz and Bordeaux. They're about, I think, 100 miles south of Tehran. Well, they're very difficult targets. You're not going to damage them with cruise missiles or conventional ordnance. They are most susceptible to something called the massive ordnance penetrator, which is a huge bomb that burrows very deep into the ground. The Natanz facility is under about 300 feet of bedrock, and Bordeaux is burrowed into a mountain. They're very difficult targets. They would be the most highly desired targets from Israel's perspective and the neoconservative perspective. Where they can fly from the United States, they can go on B-2 Spirit bombers that would fly off from New Mexico and or Missouri. They can be refueled over along the way. I just don't think it's going to happen. I think it's posturing, and I think, as the previous guest said, signaling Iran that it should not retaliate robustly for the assassination of the nuclear scientists. Trump may want to just leave the region in a mess for Biden. I just don't think so. I think we're dealing here with smoke and mirrors, sound and fury. We've seen it before.
Yeah, Brian, Brian mentioned something many of our other experts I've talked to also mentioned the same thing, that this is the last days of President Trump at the Oval Office, and he's doing certain things, and he may want to, as the other guests said, to leave the region in a mess. Something for a president like Joe Biden to go ahead with and try to tackle. What's your opinion?
Well, I think that it's clear that Trump is highly in a highly erratic state. I mean, he usually is, more so than usual. I think that it's possible that he could order some kind of action. I think that I don't think that the military commanders are looking for that. And the reason that I think they're not looking for it is not that they wouldn't like to bring down Iran and bring down the government of Iran. Iran's a large country with a large population. It's quite developed and so forth. But at the same time, the national security strategy of the United States, which was adopted, the most recent one, I believe it was in December 2017, said that the main item on the agenda, theater of conflict would be with really China and Russia. That it talked about major party conflict. You can't take that any other way, and Iran is not a major power in that regard. Iran does not have nuclear weapons. China and Russia do. China is really seen as the number one problem by the U.S. ruling elite, in that they see China as overtaking the U.S. in different ways, economically, and not militarily, certainly, but politically in terms of its influence around the world. So that's really, and you can see both from all of the advisors around Biden, as well as Trump, that they see China as their main enemy in the coming period. But I have to say again that the deployment of so much military force, if you look down through the history, you can see, I was actually just looking at it today, the photos of the collisions that have taken place between warships and the possibility that collisions could cause a nuclear disaster. There's no question that that can happen. And the war sometimes happens without either side intending war to happen. They climb the escalation ladder, as it's called, step by step, but end up somewhere where neither side perhaps wanted to be at the beginning. So this kind of war gaming, if that's what it is really hazardous.
Brian, let's take a look at another aspect of the story. Iran has offered the Hormuz Peace Initiative to Arab states, the Persian Gulf littoral states, while Tel Aviv has tried to forge relations with them, especially under this U.S. brokered so-called normalization deals, and that's on shared concerns about Iran. So who's assumed a destabilizing role in West Asia?
Well, I would say that the Sunni powers have really begun a lot of this out of dynastic ambitions by the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and out of religious hatred. Well, that's their view. I just hate to see the United States dragged into this, into their prejudicial programs. If I were to embark on a policy of making America great again, to coin a phrase, I don't think I'd want to be led around Middle East by the nose by Saudi Arabia and other powers. You cannot be a great power if you're just so easily manipulated by these people. It's not the way to be a great power.
Mm-hmm. Richard, let's have your comment on the same question.
I don't think that the U.S. is really being led around exactly. I think that this is the decisions that are being made in Washington, and decisions that include the shipment now of a huge amount of new weaponry to Saudi Arabia to use against the people in Yemen, where half the population is in danger of starvation. This is the relationship with Saudi Arabia. Biden may be a little bit more critical of it, but it's not going to break up the relationship. This is a long-standing relationship. Saudi Arabia really exist as a country because of the U.S. and Britain helped to bring one family to power, and it's been there for a long time, and the vast amounts of oil and the hundreds of billions, really it's trillions and trillions of dollars now in wealth that has originated from Saudi Arabia and ended up in the banks of New York, and particularly New York and London and so forth. So this is, it's a very important relationship, and U.S. policy over the last 75 years, almost 75 years now, has been, once they got out of World War II, set up the CIA and embarked on a whole course of empire on a much wider scale, has been to prevent any independent powers in the Middle East that aren't willing to toe Washington's line. That's the real history. If you really look at it in the overview, so nationalist governments, mass movements, socialist movements, communist movements, progressive movements of all kinds have been seen as the problem from Washington's point of view. And I think that that goes for Yemen today as well. It goes for all the forces in the region which aren't bowing before Washington. And the aim is to crush them.
Now, Brian, let's take a look at the U.S. military presence and deployment in different parts of the world. Can you cite a spot on planet where U.S. military deployment has restored peace and security, as they claim it? The record in countries in this part of the world, including Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, tells you otherwise.
Quick answer there is no. I would have to go back to World War II when I think American policy stabilized Central Europe and East Asia. But other than that, I think the wars in Libya, Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Not so much Afghanistan, since the troubles sort of predated the American presence there. But I think it's just led to chaos, havens for Al-Qaeda, resentment resentments against the United States in the region, and stress between the United States and longstanding allies in Europe and Asia. You know, to go back to that phrase, making America great again, American greatness was always based on strong alliances, and Donald Trump doesn't know that, and Joe Biden is going to have to repatch things in the next few years, which I think he can do. I think those countries want a strong America on their side. I'm talking about Central Europe and East Asia, not so much the Middle East. But no, Trump has just shown no knowledge of foreign policy, alliances, history. He's an arrogant, erratic person, and happily he'll be gone in a few weeks without doing more damage.
Okay. Richard, what's the right way toward restoration of calm and tranquility to West Asia region? Military deployments or dialogue and diplomacy?
Well, it's clear, I think, and I would agree with the other guests about this, is that it's created the military strategy, the strategy that's been carried out. And I do have to say, though, it's not just Trump, but it's all the recent administrations have thought that they could solve the problems mainly through military deployment. And the reality is that it has just created conditions that are abhorrent to so many people in the region. I mean, Syria is torn apart, Iraq is torn apart, Libya is torn apart. Yemen is torn apart. The result of the U.S. intervention has nothing to do with democracy, or wasn't motivated by democracy or human rights. All you have to do is look at Saudi Arabia and look at that relationship and then try to say, oh, the United States government, various administrations have been concerned about human rights in the region. I mean, so that's a terrible joke for the people who live in Saudi Arabia. The reality is that whatever the tactics have been up until now, they have just created more and more suffering for people in the Middle East. And really, the United States needs to be out of the Middle East.
Okay. Thank you very much for your comments. From the Answer Coalition, we had Richard Becker out of San Francisco, a national security analyst and political commentator. Brian Downing joined us from Florida.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
I'd like to discuss Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam in the light of the month that we are in, who gave everything for humanity.
For humanity. By brother Yasir Ibrahim.
Billahi min ash-shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيت الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين السلام عليك يا أبا عبد الله السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته dear listeners welcome to another episode for humanity an episode where we try to understand try to explore certain values certain merits, certain virtues that we can find in the history of Islam, in the Islamic tradition, and especially our current discussion on the event of Karbala, the day of Ashura, and the movement of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the eternal movement of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. The movement of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is eternal not because of the actuality of what happening on that day, but rather because of the idea it had. The idea that the Imam promoted, the idea that the Imam impressed on the hearts of the Muslims, rather not the Muslims, on mankind, on humans, on us as individuals, over 1,000 years later, still remains fresh every single year, still remains a thing that we need every single year. Muharram, Ashura, it's a place of reformation, revitalization. And if you want to say it, and you use a Christian term, a rebirth, so to speak, or a means that all of this can be achieved, a means by which all of this can be done. One of the issues that we find in the Islamic tradition, and it's something for us also to understand about Ashura, about the event of Karbala, is that justice, as we mentioned previously, which is defined as putting something in its proper place. That is, for example, a person, the example that I use, that in order to do justice for a pair of shoes, you put it in its proper place in the shoe rack or in the cupboard, and so on and so forth. This is what is known as justice. However, on a more profound note, on a deeper level, justice is putting those virtues and qualities and giving the rights to those individuals where it is deserved and in the best manner. In Islamic tradition, this type of putting something in its proper place is also in unity, or is also, you know, one with intellectuality, that is rationalism, a person's thinking. And this can be seen very clearly in the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, none more so than the traditions of Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib, who, when asked to define what is wisdom, what is the intellect, what is it that one is intellectual, one thinks, You know, he says that being intellectual, or an intellectual person rather, is that person who puts things in its proper place. And then the Imam was then asked, who is a jahil? Or who is an ignorant person? The Imam replies, I've already told you that an ignorant person, a jahil, is that person who is opposite to the intellectual person. If an intellectual person is that person who puts things in its proper place, a jahil is that person who does not put things, a jahil is that person who does not put things in its proper place. And this is the tradition from Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. And therefore we see that the movement of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam and his stand and uprising against oppression was in order to awaken not only the heart of people, but also to awaken the intellect, also to awaken that deep rational faculty that we as human beings have, in order for human beings to see and to understand and to fathom the truth and to fathom falsehood, for them to realize that this is oppression, for them to come to the realization that, you know, a normal person under normal circumstances will not take this, an intellectual person will not stand for this type of oppression. And the movement of Imam Hussein was just that this movement was to intellectualize the people and to take them away from the ignorance that had dominated over them since the death of the Holy Prophet, and rather since the death of his beloved father, Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. So this is one of the things that we should realize, is that this movement is not just a movement in terms of, you know, emotional, but rather it is a movement in which our hearts are awakened, our minds are awakened. And therefore when we cry, when we shed tears for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, we should not just shed tears because we are listening to a sad story, or we are seeing, for example, a sad movie. You know, we have individuals who can watch the movie or a movie 10 times and cry at the very same scene every single time. So it's not something that is far-fetched. There are people for 20 odd years, 25 years, 30 years, 40 years, go to the majalis of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, listen to the same masaib and the heart-rendering events of the day of Ashura, and they still cry because it is something that is heart-rendering, but they do not take it as a means of reformation. They do not take it as a means to open up and to unlock that intellect that a person has, that intellect that has been given as a proof by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala upon people. Hence, when a person cries, it is that tears which are shed with an intellectual basis, that those tears that are shed in order for the intellect to be awakened. And we see that there is a correspondence here, a duality here, that these tears affect both the intellect and affects the heart, that it enables the intellect to open and to see realities if done properly. And on the flip side, it soothes the heart, it refreshes the heart, it gives the heart that ability to see light again. These tears of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, if done with the intention of unlocking the intellect, with the intention of purifying the heart, it has an amazing effect on it. So we see that the movement of Imam alayhi salam, as most individuals and some scholars have said, it's not just a movement in which the Imam did for himself. I mean, the Imam did not just do it in order for him to gain power, or not do it in order for him to do Amr al-Ba'ruf or Nahi al-Munkar, that is forbidding the evil and commanding the good, or promoting the good and forbidding the evil. But the Imam did it so